All I wanted to do was to follow Naz, to be with the man that I loved. And in a moment when I was about to take my own life, I heard Naz's voice. And Naz's voice told me to set up a foundation or a charity that would help other people in a similar situation to us so that they wouldn't have to go through what we went through.
To Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, founder of purpose-led communications agency Higginson Strategy, and I believe that the best way to get a message across clearly is by talking about something you honestly and passionately believe in. By doing so, you bring people with you, your passion becomes theirs, and I call this the power of purpose. Today, I'm joined by the multi-award-winning activist, filmmaker, and founder and CEO of the Naz and Matt Foundation, Matt Mahmood Ogston. The Naz and Matt Foundation is a specialist charity that works to remove the barriers that prevent religious and cultural conservative parents from accepting their LGBTQ plus children. For the last decade, Matt has transformed the lives of thousands of individuals and has campaigned tirelessly in the press about suicide prevention and greater acceptance of LGBTQ plus people within conservative communities. Alongside his work at the foundation, Matt supports businesses to develop personal branding through his filmmaking, photography, and UX design expertise, and also runs Bonaparte, a digital magazine for content creators to make a positive difference in the world. Matt, it's great to have you on the show. Please just share the story of how the Naz and Matt Foundation came to be.
Thank you so much, John, for inviting me on today. Yes, of course. So the Naz and Matt Foundation, well, let me take you back a few years before that to tell you why the charity was started. So back in 2001, I'd recently come out to myself when I was 23 years old. I'd recently come out to myself. What I mean by coming out to myself was I finally grew stronger than the prejudice and the homophobia that existed in the community that I grew up in. And on a night out, I was just, I just started to go out and find myself and explore. And on that night, that lonely night, I was sitting in an after hours nightclub, and along came a sweet, delicate voice that said in my ear, "Excuse me, may I sit here, please?" And in that moment, my whole life changed, because in that moment, Naz had arrived. And Naz sat down next to me and we started talking. And he quickly told me, I think the third question after asking my name, he asked me, well, he told me he was from a very conservative religious family, and he would never be able to come out to his family because he feared what might happen if and when he came out to them. So we quickly fell in love, madly, deeply in love, and within a few months, you know, we were talking about eloping to Gretna Green. We moved in soon afterwards, but living in Birmingham, which was the city we were both born in, we realised that it wasn't a particularly safe city for us to be in. You know, we could never walk down the street together because Naz feared what might happen if his family saw us walking together, if they thought we were somehow, you know, a relationship. You know, we couldn't even have the blinds open in our front room because Naz feared what might happen if his family drove past and saw us. So we went away to the bright lights of London, to find freedom, to be ourselves, to live what many people just call a normal life, where you can just walk down the street without fear of something happening to you. So we, on our 10-year anniversary of that night, I got down on one knee in a packed nightclub, and asked Naz to marry me. And that was the happiest day of my life, being engaged to the man that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. In 2014, we both travelled from Birmingham up to London, sorry, from London up to Birmingham to see our family. It was Eid, and Naz went to visit his family. And as we were leaving that family, as he was leaving that family event, there was a confrontation. And that confrontation led Naz to break down in tears with his family. And in those tears, one of his parents came over to him and says, "Why are you crying? Why are you crying? Is it because you like men?" And Naz was 34 at the time. He's a doctor, a Harley Street GP as well. Very successful in what he does, much loved in the community. But at the age of 34, he was asked a question, and he thought he would never get asked directly. which is why you're crying. Why you're crying, is it because you like men? And Naz didn't know how to lie. Would actually get him into trouble sometimes because he didn't know how to do anything that remotely close to a lie. And in that moment, he answered honestly, and he said to the question, "Yes, it is because I like men. I'm in love with Matt. We're engaged and married. We've been together for 13 years." And the parents' response was to tell him to go and see a psychiatrist to be cured, because they'd heard gay people like him, or men who liked men, and they heard that they'd been cured on radio programs in the UK. And that conversation was left unfinished. And I am missing some details out just for kind of to be succinct. But 2 days after that confrontation, I got a phone call to come home, but I wasn't told why. And as I ran up the hill to the place that we'd recently moved to, when I turned the corner to the road that we lived, I saw crowds gathered, police everywhere, police tape cordoning off the scene. And as I tried to enter the property that we had moved to recently, that's when I saw a red blanket on the floor. And that's when I started to realize that something really wasn't right. And as the police put me in the back of the police car, that's when they said the words that it was desperate for them not to say. And that's when they said that Naz was no longer here. The man that I loved was no longer here. And it was Naz that was under that blanket. And then I just lost it. And the police told me to, ordered me to take me away. And in the days that followed, all I wanted to do was to follow Naz, to be with the man that I loved, to be with him. And in a moment when I was about to take my own life, instead of taking my own life, I heard Naz's voice. It was a loud, bellowing voice. And he said, and Naz's voice told me to set up a foundation or a charity or something or a group that would help other people in a similar situation to us, so that, well, they wouldn't have to go through what we went through. And in answer to your question, that's where the Naz and Matt Foundation came from. It wasn't my idea. It was a voice that I heard of Naz that stopped me from taking my own life. And I started to realize, if that's to save my life, why can't we use it to help others?
Well, Matt, thank you for that incredibly sad story. But from that incredibly sad story over the last 10 years, you've created some real positives from that. And can you just tell us about some of those things that the Naz and Matt Foundation now do?
Yes, of course. So the Naz and Matt Foundation, it was announced that I was launching or starting the Naz and Matt Foundation just a couple of weeks after Naz passed away. But we didn't know what we were going to do. We just knew that we had to create something. I just knew we had to create something that would help support other individuals. And it wasn't until a few months later that Naz's story actually became public as to why he really took his own life. And it was then when it broke on, first of all, it was Sky News and it was BBC News. That's when individuals started to contact us. And, speaking to family members, what they'd said to me is, "Now is not the time for you to decide what the charity needs to do. Now is the time for you to listen to what others want you to do for the charity, with the charity to help support them." So we initially started off as a campaign organisation where we would campaign in the press to help people understand the seriousness and the scale of what it's like to be born into a religious and culturally conservative family when you're also born LGBTQI plus. Because what I was hearing from the many people that were contacting us now, the hundreds of people who are contacting us now, that they thought they were the only one from their religious or cultural background. They thought they were the only one that was LGBT. They thought they was the only one who had these feelings. They'd never seen another person like them on TV or on the radio or the newspaper. So what we started to realize is that we need to. Other people were saying, "But I thought this problem had gone away. I thought this was something that was happening in the 70s and the 80s." But in actual fact, it hadn't. It actually was getting worse at the time. So what we did initially was to campaign and actually raise awareness about this existing and actually help create a story in people's minds that would help them understand it so they could actually start helping other people that they might know in their community. So we've done a lot of outreach work, we've done a lot of campaign work, we've done huge amounts of campaign work, we've worked on campaigns to help the government change their position on things. But most importantly now, where we spend most of our time is providing one-to-one support and group support to some of the most vulnerable LGBTQI individuals in our community and also their parents.
Have you found in the last 10 years that there has been a shift towards acceptance of LGBTQ people in some of those more conservative communities in the last 10 years since you've been campaigning?
There definitely has been a shift. There is still so much work that needs to be done, but there has definitely been a shift because, for example, when Naz was alive, I can't recall at all, and certainly Naz never mentioned it to me, where we had never seen anyone in public on the TV, on like the radio, on a newspaper, on a magazine. We'd never seen someone from Naz's religious background before. He was queer or was LGBTQI. He was proudly talking about it from a place of confidence. So what we've seen in the shift over the last decade is a really positive shift towards seeing so many individuals who are from a very similar background to Naz being visible in public, being visible on social media, being visible in the press, being visible in the streets, you know, even leading pride marches a few years ago in Birmingham. And I think that's a massive shift. And so much of that shift, I think, has come through conversations, because so much of the work we do is by having conversations, not debates, but conversations to actually raise the level of understanding. Because so much of the work we do with families, the root cause of the issue is actually coming from a place of fear. And how do we address fear? We address fear by understanding something. So the way to address understanding is through education, and done in the right way that actually works and is designed and is complementary to the audience that we're trying to basically work with the most, which is really the parents. Because the parents are the ones that can make this problem go away. It's not the religious leader, it's the parents who can make this problem go away.
Well, that leads nicely onto an event that I know that you organised that I hope that Higginson Strategy can support you with this year, which is Out and Proud Parents, because there's lots of members of Higginson Strategy that are very passionate about LGBTQ rights. So I hope we can help you there. Can you just highlight to our listeners what that is?
Out and Proud Parents Day is an annual celebration of parents who are out and proud about their LGBTQI plus children. We hold it every year on the 30th of July, which is the day that Naz sadly passed away. So we wanted to reclaim that day and use it in a way that could actually help other families. So what's so special about our Out and Proud Parents is that we thankfully see now a lot more positive role models, a lot more LGBTQI plus positive role models in the press, in the media, which is amazing. But what we don't see is we don't see parents of those LGBTQI individuals talking about their experiences. Because when you're from a conservative or religious background, when your child comes out, when you accept your child who is LGBTQI plus, you as a parent then need to come out to your family and your community, because you then have to announce to everyone that you're proud and you're accepting of them. So it's almost like they have to go through their own coming out process. So Out and Proud Parents Day is a platform, it's a celebration of parents to help inspire other parents from a similar religious background or cultural background, or no background or no religious background at all, but to inspire other parents to really see role models who they can actually aspire to be or work towards, or in many cases, many of the parents who take part, they can be contacted on social media, and many of the parents want other parents to contact them. So from a practical perspective, it's actually a real huge ripple effect and amplification of the marketing, sorry, the support that we can provide, because now we have parents all around the world who can also provide that support directly to other parents, which is incredible.
Great. We'll provide details of that in the notes on this episode as well. Just tell me, what for you makes a really good message?
What makes a really good message, ultimately, is something that actually creates a reaction, an emotional reaction within the person who reads or sees or experiences that message. So the way that we approach practically all of our work, including our support work, including our marketing, our campaign work, all of it, we always start at the end point. So who is it that we're talking to, and what do we want them to feel when they've experienced what we're about to start? So it could be, for example, in many of our campaigns, we're visualizing Naz as his younger version of himself, who's at home who's scared about his family, who can't come out to his family. He might be on a computer or a smartphone and he comes across a piece of media, and we want that piece of media or video, we want that to talk to the younger version of Naz, and we want when Naz, the younger version of Naz, to experience that content, this is how we want them to feel. And it's the same with our work with parents, when we do our Parents Day, when we do video interviews. Ultimately, the words are almost irrelevant. The structure of those words is almost irrelevant. What's most important is when the person has finished, the audience has finished watching their video, what is the feeling that we wanted them to feel? And if we can encourage or we can lead that person to feel that feeling, then we've achieved success in that message.
And what kind of communication strategies have you found most effective when trying to get the public on side or politicians on side?
What's been most effective is, it really comes back to what we're just talking about with the message. It's the simplicity in a story, but certainly the backbone of everything we do includes a story. Because so many people want to hear the story of Naz and Matt. They want to hear why it happened, but also what the future is. So I think what we had to learn over the years is that, first of all, if we want to engage with news platforms, then they want news. And I remember a few years ago, I've got a good few contacts at the BBC, and I remember we were trying to pitch a certain campaign we wanted to start, and it was going nowhere. And I was like, well, hang on a minute, normally you cover things that we do. And they said, okay, we are a news channel. The clue is in the word news. And I said, what do you mean? They said, it has to be new. It has to be new to make it news. And I took that and it really made sense. So everything we do has to be new. Even if we are talking about something we've talked about before, we have to say in a new way, with a new story, with a new angle, with a new perspective. So for example, I think it was 2021, it might have been, we did one of our biggest ever campaigns, which was World Suicide Prevention Day. Now, it was a press and media and broadcast campaign primarily, and we achieved with that campaign, I still can't believe this number, but what we got back from our agency was that we managed to reach, or we had a reach of 54 million people with the press campaign, because we did the most interviews I've ever done. I think we did, in a 3-day period with the middle day off, so basically 2 days, I did 28 interviews, and some of those interviews were syndicated across other radio stations. And all of the interviews, well, no, so probably about 80-90% of those interviews were with programs that had a religious focus to them. So that was a lot of interviews, and we were sharing our story. And I thought, well, we've shared our story so many times, you know, what is it that we can say differently? And of course, we were talking about it on World Suicide Prevention Day. So what we found was that we could create the new piece of news by talking about an existing story in a way that would actually might be very important for that particular day in the calendar. And of course, our whole story starts, not starts, but the whole story of Naz and Matt Foundation starts with, sadly, Naz taking his own life. So it's incredibly relevant. And I think also, if I'm just add, not being afraid to say the things that need to be said, but being respectful always along the way.
Very good. I think it's a good point there for people to remember that the news has to be new. And another thing to remember about news is that it comes from the compass. It comes from north, east, west and south. And so news is what happens everywhere. What's been one of the most rewarding moments in the last 10 years for you?
I can say that the two most rewarding moments in all of our work, I mean, to be honest, I'm actually proud of so many things that myself and the team have achieved, but really the two things that are the most rewarding. One is when we've been working with an LGBT individual and they are struggling to come out to their own conservative parents and they've come to us for assistance, for help. Sometimes when people come to us in that situation, our advice is categorically, do not come out to your family. We will help you leave your family. We will find and help you build a new life somewhere else that's safe. But when we're in a situation where, after working with that individual together, we feel it is a possibility for them to come out to their family. To then, you know, months later or years later sometimes, but when we get the call or we get the email to say they have come out and the response from their parent was positive, encouraging, and accepting, because they put in all of that hard work to get that parent to that place. Because you can't just come out. You have to plan it. You have to educate your parents in such a way that it doesn't cause controversy or conflict rather, when they come out. But then the second most rewarding time is when we're helping individuals who have had to leave their country of birth because they have death threats from their family, from the law enforcement agencies in those countries, and they do whatever they can to survive, to leave that country. They're in the UK, and we'll work with that person to help document their story in order for, you know, the powers of the be to be able to understand the real risks of that person. And when we get the phone call or when we get the email to say that that person has been granted safety in the UK, that their life is now protected, I can't describe how much of a wonderful feeling that is to know that we played some part in helping save that person. And now we can work with them to help them rebuild an amazing life ahead of them. And that's just a wonderful feeling to be able to see in someone else's eyes the new hope that they have for living a normal, in quotes, life.
Yeah, that's wonderful that you're able to do that. I know that the NASA MAP Foundation operates on a real shoestring budget, and there'll be listeners listening to this who are in a similar position. What advice would you give to those nonprofits that have very tight budgets on how to leverage media and public relations to further their causes?
Thank you. It's a really, really important question. It is really important. I'd say that my biggest piece of advice is to focus and remind yourself on the why. Why did you start your nonprofit? Why did you start your NGO? Why did you start your charity? What was the story behind starting that? And then find the right way of telling that story, and being almost brutal about how you tell that story. Brutal in the sense of simplifying it, making sure that there's humans involved in that story, making sure that you're able to tell that story. And I would say one really good place to actually study is really look at how entrepreneurs start their startups. You know, that there's a concept of elevator pitch. I don't really hear that in the charity world, but I certainly hear it every single startup I've ever spoken to. What's their elevator pitch? So if you were in a lift with the person, you know, the example everyone always says is, if you were in a lift with Richard Branson, you know, what would you say to that? How would you tell them all about your charity in two sentences or one sentence? Because if you can simplify your whole charity and your story and your journey and your mission down to one or two sentences, that's the starting point, and then build on that from there. And then when you've started to build that story and you look at then into how you tell a powerful story with a hook, with a beginning, a middle and an end, and then you can actually then start thinking about, well, how can I apply that story, our story, to a news event, to an activity that we want to do? And then who can I tell this story to? So you can't just say, I want to tell it to the BBC. It's like, well, is it Current Affairs? Is it BBC London? Is it the politics show? Is it, you know, what area of the BBC? Find the person and then practice your story. That's like one really good place to actually practice storytelling is to join a pitching event. It could be a startup pitching event. You know, you could get a cheeky entry into a startup pitching event. You're in front of people, pitch your charity to everyone in the room. Because what you want to make sure is that you've got it perfected, you actually got it, you're comfortable with saying it when you get in the room in front of a potential funder. You know, you want to have it really refined. When you get in front of a journalist or a news reporter, you want to be able to very clearly articulate your why, your mission, your purpose. Because ultimately what we've found is that, understandably so, individuals who work in BBC, ITV News, etc., they're really busy people. And the more that you can actually provide a complete package of, this is what it's about, this is where it's coming from, this is what we want to achieve, can you help? And by the way, here are all the assets, the photos, the videos, the dates. Here's everything that you need to know to make a decision. And that person then can actually make a decision rather quickly without having to do a lot of legwork. Because if you make their job easy, they're more likely to, not necessarily, but they're more likely to perhaps work with you if they are poor on time. So make it as easy and realise that, build those relationships, because the people who have the power of the press and the media, they're humans as well. And quite often they just want to build a human connection to the individuals where they're getting their story and content from.
Make it easy for the journalist. Good advice there. What message would you give
Yes.
to your younger self?
It's a simple question. What I would say to my younger self on the 30th of July 2014 is don't go to work. Stay at home with NASA. And everything will be okay if you do that. That's what I'd like to say to my younger self.
Very, very difficult. So finally, how can listeners get involved if they've heard your story and want to get involved? How can they support your work and what you're doing?
If anyone listening would like to support our work, the easiest way is follow us on the socials, tweet, amplify, share. The second important way would be if you work in a larger organisation or an organisation with the resources, please find a way of actually trying to fund our work. We can come and do talks, but also we accept donations because a small grassroots charity like ours, we're a very small team. We work a lot of long hours, and we really need funding to be able to pay for the time that that people work on the charity. I guess the third thing would be, we love working with individuals who come to the charity with a project. For example, our film My God, I'm Queer. That film, that award-winning film that went on to Channel 4. That started off because I met with somebody who wanted to make a film, and I wanted to make a film. Neither of us had made a film before, but we wanted to do it together, and she wanted to be a producer, and she now is a producer. So I'd say come to us with your skill, look for an opportunity, and then work with us to help make that come to fruition. Because we're such a small charity, it's difficult to manage volunteers without a particular who haven't come with a particular skill. So if you're amazing at paid advertising, please come and help us. If you're amazing at email marketing, please come and help us. If you're amazing at strategic outreach that's beyond what we already do, please help us. If you know a philanthropist, that's probably I should have said the first. If you know a philanthropist, please just get us a meeting in front of them. We will do the work. We will talk to them. We will share our story. But just if you could just set up a meeting with them, we would be eternally grateful, because what you don't normally hear from charities is the hard work that has to go behind the scenes just to keep the lights on and just to pay the team. Basically, it's just to keep things going, because funding is at an all-time difficult level to get hold of. So, and we can't help our community. We received 372 requests for support last year from a part-time team of three people in our support team. That's a lot of support requests, particularly as each request might, we might be working with that person for a year or two or even 3 years sometimes.
Matt Mahmood Ogston, founder and CEO of the NAS and MAP Foundation. You've been speaking to me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose. If you'd like to know more about how Higginson Strategy supports purpose-led organisations, visit higginsonstrategy.com.